This episode of Creativity in Captivity is sponsored by the Curtis Theater in Brea, California, presenting Don Reed's The Never Too Late Show on Saturday, May 11th. Tickets are available at the Curtis Theater website. Get ready for insight and inspiration on the creative process from an array of artists, writers, and visionaries on May 9th, when Season 7 of Creativity in Captivity kicks off. In the meantime, please enjoy over 150 episodes hosted by Pat Hazel with a stable of creative guests in our listening lounge at creativityincaptivity.fun.
This is Creativity in Captivity, and I'm Pat Hazel. Today, I am joined by an extraordinary entertainer and a sought-after speaker on the art of deception and attention management. He is a security consultant and one of the world's leading experts on pickpockets, confidence crimes, and diversion techniques. He is a go-to guy as a consultant for film and television, and joining me now is the gentleman thief and artful manipulator of awareness, Apollo Robbins.
That spark of electricity, a skipping stone that sets you free, you're captive to a mystery, the curse of creativity. La 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 la.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and flattered by the invitation.
Well, you came highly recommended by a mutual friend, Gary Staub, who is the guru of sculpting dinosaurs, and another guy who does a job that people can't figure out how you get the job or how you get paid for it.
And such remarkable attention to detail. He sees things that nobody else does.
So, I mean, I think maybe that's what you have in common in your conversation, because every little nuance of what people do and where their attention is paid, you are really zoned in on it. Like, as much as anybody I know, you can track people's eye movement. You know what they're feeling. You know how to make something memorable. Deception is a very, very interesting art to be an expert at. So let's just talk about deception on its own. How vulnerable are we to deception externally and also internally?
You know, it's kind of interesting the way you just said it. I think you kind of captured something a little bit broader than deception, and deception lays right in the middle. That there's this threshold of everything that we notice, and then we as humans edit out a lot of things that we think are irrelevant. And we just leave it on the editing floor because it wasn't a highlight and these other things get left behind. And I think I've been a fan of several magicians over the years, like Tommy Wonder and these other guys that do almost misdirection right in front of you. And they're able to predict what someone will attend to and what they'll forget. And that ability to notice or predict what someone forgets is a really interesting pathway to someone's blind spots. And I think for deception, that's a really key part, because once you identify where someone's blind spots are, what they'll attend to, what they'll remember, and what they forget, you really start to have the raw materials to design a deception.
And isn't that partly about the patterns of what becomes routine to them, what they begin to accept as, oh, I don't need to pay attention to that?
Absolutely. And we can think of that so much in every day as a simple way of autopilot, what becomes routine to us. You'll notice there's these things that are unusual to us that are kind of anomalies, and they become highlights. When you have it highlighted, it draws in the attention. It becomes more salient. And I think that that's, as a magician or thief or pickpocket like it myself, my job is to curate those highlights, to make sure that the ones that they attend to happen on the timeline when I want them to. And meanwhile, the things I don't want them to attend to get lost in the noise.
How many hundreds of ways are there to distract a person? I mean, you're in their personal space as a pickpocket. How does that not feel unusual to them?
It's an interesting piece. I think if you think of how we collect information, you can balance that between our senses and our attention and the relationship between those two things. Does your attention guide what you're going to look at, if you think of it like a camera? But that can go to a system or can go to a person, for example. And if I can set up your expectations of what you're looking for, I can now start to shape where you point your camera, where you point your eyes, or what you choose to listen for. So when you dive deeper into the black box, you start to see it's not just stopping them from seeing something or stopping them from attending to them. How do I shape their expectations? And now you start to move into story. How do they make sense, or what is the story they're going to tell themselves about what they see? And if I can prime that in some way, that's fantastic.
Meaning that you are like a lawyer who knows the result they want on the stand, and they lead the story in the question in some way. So in misdirection, which you and I have some awareness of having started in the magical arts, to people that feels like, hey, look over here. But in the storytelling, sometimes you'll give them a responsibility to hold something or to think of something. And just in the dialogue, in the way you ask the question, how important is that for them to go into their memory or to go somewhere searching for the answer, which completely takes their attention away?
If you think of that as a story being told in multiple platforms, you can think of it also as a term that we use often as observable narrative. It's not an explicit story that we say, but it's one that they observe through a variety of channels that they collect on. And if you think of it that way, back to the attention piece, you have an attentional pie, where are those resources going to be sliced up and used? And that could be because I hand them a thing to hold on to, or I ask them a question in the past tense that doesn't make sense. For example, like, do you still have your American Express? It's something that now posits them and switches their internal attention to an internal focus versus external broad. Often my goal with those is to move them from one attentional style to another one. And that's usually depending on the context.
You're gaining trust. The main thing with confidence or a confidence game or confidence man is that you have got to gain their confidence in order to have access to them and what you want.
Can I add a note to that as a caveat? So trust would be kind of the relationship. And when you take confidence, it can also be amplify their internal confidence. So if I'm able to amplify their confidence so it moves beyond a threshold and they become overconfident, now they have a vulnerability. It's the same as like in sparring where somebody reaches out of their range. If they move into waters that I've got them to lift the anchor and now I'm their only support system in those deeper waters, that's some helpful ways to think about it. But do they realize that they've now lifted their anchor? They no longer have firm standing. They no longer have credibility. I think it's just beyond trust into pushing them into overconfidence.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm a big fan of the study of con games and heist movies. And I think partly as an audience member, everybody feels smarter watching a heist movie because they're getting seated with information. And a really good heist movie is pulling a different heist on the viewer than when you think, oh, I know how this is going to happen. You've probably watched so many of these or consulted on many of these. Isn't a heist movie, in being well done, typically a con on the viewer as well as the people in the movie?
It is. I think it's also knowing who your audience is and how they're observing the story. Because we can assume that we are watching this story, or we can find out that we're immersed in this story. I did a TED Talk once upon a time, and it's a small thing, kind of like you're speaking to. There's a layered story for different audiences. There's a story of that's happening to that audience that I'm with. There's a story of what happens to the guy they bring onto the stage. And then there's a story for the home viewer. And each one of those has different considerations, because in real life, you can't rewind. So that first swing for all those audiences there is to kind of give them the behavior of the attentional manipulation. But when you can rewind, the attention manipulation doesn't work as well if you can rewind back. So it's designed for now audiences at home to be able to rewind it and then share with their friends and watch them watch it. That's similar to sometimes the heist movies. They have this A, B, and C story. Orson Welles is very popular for this, for having these three options of moving through story and back to this and back at the ranch. But it's similar with the con element too.
In any kind of heist, bank job, let's say ensemble thing, you have to deal with, of course, the team members of the heist, but also every imaginable situation. There are thousands of details. And as a security consultant, you have to be thinking always the same way as the heist team is thinking. You have to think of you mentioned vulnerabilities, which I love that word, because it is that blind spot that becomes the very thing you exploit to have access.
You know, if you flip the blind spot, you find opportunity. And that's a very interesting thing, because if you can identify someone's blind spot, you're going to first probably collide with their ego if it's an individual versus a company. Sometimes companies have that too. They don't want to recognize a vulnerability. But often there's this very fertile soil for opportunities for them to either shore up their vulnerabilities, but also to find markets they didn't expect. But for security, yeah, it's the ability to identify the autopilot that we talked about before, what they assume are routine things, what are things that cross thresholds that are forgettable, that have authority to move between spaces? What exceptions are they making to their own guidelines? And you're usually trying to identify those to find the soft spots.
Do you ever sort of just dream up a heist scenario and think, okay, now how would I go through this exercise?
Yeah, I think these days I'm a lot more of a dreamer. I used to experiment a lot more, meaning I used to go and try them. And some of that, there's a space, physical penetration testing or pen testing, where you get hired to see what you can do in accessing a place. And I participated with some friends that work in that space a little bit. But I think the space for creating that, now you see different things that are protocols that, as new technologies come online, people start to outsource their thinking to the new technology. And those repeatedly are kind of on-ramps to take a vulnerability. So that's always emerging.
Because as a storyteller, I'm always walking into a scenario where I go, oh, I can go through this metal detector, and if I had a metal cane and they took the cane from me and took it around the outside, it's a fantasy that I will never do. I'll admit sometimes it's dark. Like sometimes there'll be a person in the produce aisle and I say, oh, if I just took that plastic bag and pull it over their head, they would stop annoying me the way they're thumping that melon.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, without the plastic bag, I'll give you an example of something like that. If I use a piece of string and a piece of tape, sometimes that MacGyvering of those things, you look at the protocols of what are normal for like TSA, they have us walk through body scanners all the time and they tell us to do certain things. They tell us to put our hands on our head or to put our hands up in the air. And if you notice, there's a distinction between those two things. They're two separate things, putting our hands on our head versus putting our hands in the air. But sometimes they give us some wiggle room between those two. So if I consider that as a range of motion that they now tell me to do, it's kind of akin to the space of a con game. Since they're telling me to do it, it's a rule that they've told me to do, it's now a safe space for me to do something. So if I just simulate that, could I use that to beat a body scanner? Well, taking what we just said, if we look at the audiences, you walk in through that TSA checkpoint, who are your audiences when you look around? You're going to have family, kids, different heights. You're going to have the security cameras. What angle are they at? Like 15 degrees, 45 degrees. Are they low? Are they high? You're going to have the TSA agents, but it's helpful to separate them by the roles. Like there's the people who push the bin carts, the people who tell you to take your luggage out. There's people who are watching the x-ray machine. But the people who are watching the body scanner aren't co-located with you, as they're often in a remote site watching you through the scanner's information, so they can see the density and the visual. They're the people that get to see you naked. So in that, there's ambiguity between the roles of how they communicate with each other. For example, if you carry a gun through, they probably have a button to push to escalate the scene quite a bit. But where's that threshold between now them calling someone, picking up the phone? Usually the way they communicate to someone to check a zone is they just indicate on a stick figure, check out this zone by his left knee. So I might have experimented with something like that in my youth to see how to get past something in a TSA.
Right, I like that phrasing.
Yeah, once upon a time, as we're telling stories. If in a hypothetical situation, I were to walk through a TSA checkpoint and I took a piece of thread and I ran it down the back of my collar through my waistline down to my calf, how would that help me? And now let's say I put a large amount of cash and it's a block of cash that I shouldn't be carrying because they won't let me pass without $10,000 worth of cash without registering it first. So let's say I just have this large block of cash down by my calf. And if I walk through, is the person in the other space going to push a button and call or pick up the phone? Or are they going to, is it within the threshold that they now just say, check that zone? If they tell them to check that zone, if I could pull that thread up and it moved to another zone, like up my thigh, would they still check going up, or would they stop at the zone where they were told to check? There's a cool term in security called satisfaction of search. And in behavioral economics, they call it satisficing. But it's the same kind of idea, the bounding of curiosity. And that's very important for so much of this is I want to stop them from being curious and give them an answer. So if my pants had a zipper on it around that spot, I knew that normally when they see that zipper, they mistake it for the signal or the anomaly. Then now I can start to have potential to beat this body scanner with just a piece of thread and tape. By using the hand motion of taking my hands out to the side or putting them on my head, when I walk through, they tell me to put my hands up. I hook the thread with my thumb. I pull. It pulls it up into a new zone. They check that zone. There's nothing there. I release. And now it goes back to where it was. So that kind of finding the gaps between those spaces is kind of a way you can apply that to security.
And maybe you could use double-sided tape to put $100 bills under your toupee. A toupee would seem like a safe spot for right. for some cash.
You know, actually, it's a funny thing because there are these boundaries of where the personal lines of which they won't cross. And there's some certain human factors, right? Like here in the U.S., the TSA is bridled by time. They have to let a certain amount of people through. And they also don't have a lot of authority at the first level to tell you you can't fly. So people in secondary do, when it escalates to secondary. The first swing don't usually have that authority like you do in Tel Aviv.
You did move from entertainment to reality.
My wife and I created a company a long time ago, once upon a time, called WizMob Incorporated. And we were trying to recruit thieves. And it was really bounded off this book by a linguist professor in Louisville, Kentucky. And he would infiltrate teams of thieves and study their language. And I was so fascinated by that. My wife had a background in cognitive science, and she was really interested in beyond performing, how do we take this into a study of these kind of communities? And we infiltrated groups with pickpockets, with diversion crime in general. Sometimes that's boosters or shoplifters. Sometimes it's guys that break into places like second story people or cat burglars you'd think of. And we recruited a group of about 13 people, roughly, hackers and other things. And we learned a ton along the way.
Yeah, it seems like those people would be the least interested in joining groups or sharing information.
Absolutely. And it's an interesting kind of contrast because their worlds are to be invisible, to blend. And when you start pulling them into the light, it's a very adverse reaction to them. And there's this pickpocket, D.I., Dennis Ivory, Gary Scott. He had a lot of names. He saw me. I was trying to pull him into doing this at a security conference while I was talking to some police. I reached in this guy's pocket and I stole from him while I was talking to him. And he says, man, you spank a pappy while you got a lock on. And a lock means just I'm holding on to what I was about to steal from. And it's very counterintuitive, this idea of talking to them and stealing at the same time, let alone pushing them into how do we talk about your process? Because they also have a sense of guilt that starts to come to the surface if they talk about it to an audience. Some do, some don't. Some are more pathological.
Yeah, I was going to say a pathological person would have an ego, maybe some glorified sense that they're being sort of the number one pickpocket in some way. Their vanity may come forward a little bit.
A good example of that is Frank Abagnale. Frank Abagnale is known for what he was able to do going across the country, both his impersonation and the activities they ran. But he was the inspiration for Catch Me If You Can.
He wrote the original book. It has been a movie and a musical and a number of other things. And he's a fascinating guy because he did it so many times and with so many professions.
But if you see him now, if you see him when he speaks, he's completely flipped. He's almost like he's been born again almost. And that 180 is unusual, to your point. You usually don't see that complete turn like that.
I think he kind of, his hand was forced, among other things, which is the way out of getting, let's say, incarcerated or being locked away forever is to use these skills. And this is not uncommon as you see it in politics or you see it in, I think the worst people sort of end up getting the best offer at the end of the road. So this brings us back to something I'd like your point of view on, which is the story we tell ourselves. When they're doing it, they must have no sense of empathy or something. There must be a thing that perpetrating this, that they've justified a reason, a need for them to make a living this way.
It's a split between those. I think that there's different flavors of empathy. When you think of a lot of predators, they have a form of empathy, but they don't have the emotional empathy, perhaps. But they may have a cognitive empathy of knowing what someone's perspective is and what they need to see in order for something to happen. And you see this with a lot of animal kingdom kind of predators, that they're moderating to what their prey is, and then they pounce. So they can know what they're thinking. They just don't have the emotional link. And that's two different things, I think. But then on the other side of that, the ability to be able to make a connection to someone in a way that moves them from one thing to another, meaning to move them out of a safe zone and to move them, like I said earlier, in deeper waters. It requires them to go beyond empathy.
I was listening to the Heist podcast with Michael Caine, the How to Plan a Heist that you were a guest on, episode 6. And you talked a little bit about looking at planning a heist a little bit as a board game that cross chess with Monopoly. So I was fascinated by your chess reference and how every piece had a had its ability to move. I guess that really made it clear to me that that's how you have to assemble the team.
Absolutely. If you think of it like with the story metaphor as having acts of a series of acts, and each divide in those acts is kind of a decision point of, do I continue forward? And it's hard if you try to structure everything as sheet music because reality doesn't work that way. Once a plan confronts reality, it kind of disintegrates. But what you can do is think of it more like jazz and the ability to have if-then positions. And that's a different type of story mechanism, right? That when we're projecting something to an audience, we can improvise, but they still have levels of control because they're in our environment. When it comes to security, you do have those unpredictable, unintended audiences. And how are you going to not just improvise with them, but have thresholds to say, let's not proceed, or let's signal, or let's switch roles. And knowing who the players are on the board and where the audiences are, what sensors do they have, all become like a game. Because each audience member might have a certain type of collection of sensors to collect upon an environment. And how do you play in the line between those?
You might be interested in this analogy that when I was consulting on some story writing for a movie, the producer originally, when deciding whether to use me or not, described the whole production as a bank heist. Because ultimately, having the story, putting the crew together, doing all of that, was to get the money out of the investors, had to have all of these different people and cameramen and that sort of thing, production crew and costumer, and they're really putting on a false story in front of everybody, and they're trying to convince them it's worth putting their money into. So the money's coming from somewhere else. But this guy kept using the analogy that it was like a heist. And then when he went to hire me, he was not interested in paying the consulting price. But here's the funny thing. I basically ended the call by saying, it's fine, you called me. Let me tell you what I do in terms of story, and then you can decide if it's necessary for your team. I said, I'm a safecracker. And when you get to that part of the problem and you need a safecracker, call me. That's where I left it. Because he had all the other elements. He had a getaway car. He had the driver, right? He had the camera. He had all that stuff. And they came back a few months later. They hadn't figured the story out. They had this wandering screenplay. And so I said, what's up? And I said, you know how much it costs? He says, yeah, I need a safecracker. I think confidence in what you do and you're extraordinary at what you do becomes an invaluable tool to the person who hires you because you open up worlds to them that they don't have access to.
You mentioned a while ago about bringing back the idea about the story that you tell yourself. A lot of times why they don't have access to them is they've built this cage around their own thinking. And I think that that's where creativity comes in. I often think of creativity as kind of our ability to see between walls that other people have built for themselves. They don't associate these two things as having any concept or relation. But that's the same thing as the ability to see through walls is often what a creative lens can bring to it, or find a vulnerability. And just because you can see a connection that they don't.
We're all in that really vulnerable place of only believing in our own input, our tradition, or what vantage point we have. I think about the way so much of crime and things we see now is on video, and it's not enough to convict people. Multiple cameras, which allows for more narrative and more storytelling and the rooftop view and the side angle. Somehow the story can change despite the overwhelming evidence.
Or to that concept I mentioned earlier, like the observable narrative. If I know that you have access to all those cameras, why do I put on some variables that make you tell yourself the wrong story? You see me go through a store. You see me purchase things. You know that I have a receipt. If all those things check the boxes of what you're looking for, you're going to assume that trajectory, even though I could simulate each one of those things to have a different activity happening underneath the surface of it.
Well, now, I read a story about you pickpocketing the Secret Service while entertaining for President Jimmy Carter. And I know it was at the beginning of your career as you began to launch. And I know that you were hired as an entertainer. But did it feel like you knew that was the game plan?
We have a different way of calculating risk when we're in our 20s. Maybe we're not as good at that kind of math. And that's what I was. I was in that age bracket. I was probably 25, something like that. And I was also doing a lot of other things where a friend of mine had a consumer company, LexisNexis, and they had a government division of that. And I think it was right around, maybe it was just after that, but I was doing a lot of stealing from law enforcement. But so I thought of it in a different way. So my boss said, he asked me if we heard the president was coming through the show. He said that there'd be a security detail that was watching them. And he asked if I could try to hit the Secret Service, and it pulled me out of the spot I was in the show. And that's an important thing, because if someone comes on stage, they have a different social contract. If it's a boxing ring and somebody steps in the ring and you punch them, it's a game. If you step out of the ring, it's a felony. Similar type of thing. The social contract changes when they step into a theater. But to step out of that theater and hit them at the doors where they were sentries and they were guarding the place was a different aspect for me.
Ooh. Interesting. Yeah. So that's how it worked?
They were stationed two up at a door at different locations. And my boss asked me if I would like to try to do that. And he pulled me out of the show that night. So I did walk up. They knew who I was. They had done background checks on all of us. They asked my name. My theater name at that time was Klepto in the show. So I said Klepto. And they said, no, that's not happening. And I said, well, of course not to you. You're very well trained. And it kind of boosted the guy's confidence at first. And I used that to play between the two guys. And once I had something from those first two guys, I took a few things that meant a lot to them. They wanted me to do this to the other guys. They didn't want to be the only ones. So it kind of gave me a gateway.
I see. No, well, they became your confidence team because they gave you access. Once the guard is down, which is a referral like that, I imagine each one of those steps became, you know, still risky and still felt like you were tipping your toe into the water. But now if you got caught, they'd laugh about it.
I had the other guys to point to. Yeah. The first two were the hardest because their training was different than what I had been exposed to, the way they maintained themselves, the way they moved, and the way they looked at things and the way they tried to keep a field of view. So I had to kind of improvise my approach a little bit. But once that happened, and I single one of them off, so one of them appealed to his ego probably, and he's like, okay, you're doing this to the other guys. And he referred me and sent me on.
I would say the most daring thing in my travels was that I would tear the mattress tags off the hotel beds where it said, do not remove under penalty of law. And I did it to amuse myself because I just thought, you know, if I collected enough of them, I would have them stitched together into a bedspread. That was going to be a very funny view if you came into my room.
And this was not in your 20s. I'm guessing this is in your 30s at that point.
I had to do it for a longer period of time to get enough to make the bedspread. But there's very, very few cameras in the hotel rooms at that time. You are also really interested in directing film. I mean, the things I've seen that you've done, I feel like all of your ability to know where to make people look, it's just an extraordinary position that a director's job is very much to guide you through a story and every moment, every point of view of the camera. It's the same thing that you do live on stage, but now you have these tools and technology to tell a bigger story.
Absolutely. And I think I've advised for like groups of directors. I've done like a little workshop where they've had me come in and talk about similarities between what I do. Because again, it is that curation of attention and also the segues between like the pass off of one camera or another character walks through and what are they going to attend to? And what are they going to leave out? And are you trying to visually foreshadow some things? Officially, if you looked at my IMDb, it wouldn't show me as a director, but I produced on a TV series. I was a supervising producer for a series called Brain Games on Nat Geo. I helped work on writing some of those pieces with the core writing team to find immersive ways to design things so that they could play a social experiment on people at home in the living rooms. But then got to work in film, one particular movie, definitely not a director on that, but I was just a creative consultant, but they built a lot of the story elements from parts of a project that my wife and I had done earlier, that company Wizmob, and turned it into a movie called Focus. And it had starred Will Smith, Margot Robbie. And it was fascinating watching that whole process from the writing, construction of the story, all the way through to the filming, to the editing afterwards, and watching how that story evolves in each of those phases.
That was a great movie. I saw it, among heist movies, it kind of let us in on, it kind of pulled the curtain back, as we said earlier, on things where we go, oh, okay, I didn't notice that. Now I notice it. It was definitely a show and tell con man movie.
Absolutely. And there's small things like, I wish they had done it this way versus this way. And one small thing to that you might appreciate from having the magic background and the threshold between those worlds. I designed and choreographed a scene that happened in the French Quarter to be done with Steadicams and to follow it continuously. And from a magic perspective, as soon as you cut on TV or video, the audience can lose trust because it's a flash and they say, I don't know what happened during that cut. And it's a similar type of thing with these, but that was a different call for them because of pacing. So they were looking at pacing and flashes. But I designed initially to be kind of a pull through with a steady cam to show the full unfolding of shots. When you're doing it the flash way, you don't have to do that. It's a series of flashes for action.
And also you have to have this broader sense of what the audience is seeing because they could look anywhere in a continuous shot. And so do they stay on the character? Do they change their focus to the background or foreground? And obviously you have a certain amount of control of that, which people don't think. I think Penn and Teller use a camera storytelling in one of their tricks where in the end you are surprised who the cameraman is after that. But it is interesting that we feel safest when there's a camera on something. But we get rid of so much other points of view when we watch the camera, when we just see the camera view.
You said you watched my TED Talk just recently. There were several mistakes that happened in that. And one of those relates to the camera. They had an extra camera with a Steadicam that wasn't supposed to be there. And in the tech rehearsal, I identified where the positioned ones would be in the back, where the boom would be. But then when we showed up, as I was walking back from the audience, another camera showed up there with a Steadicam. And it was during a critical point for me, which I won't spoil it for anyone. But you'll see me lean into the camera and I'm leaning in and saying, hello. And that's partially to what we were just talking about with the different audiences. I knew that that's one of the worst things I can do for a camera because they'll have to rack focus. They're going to have to try to blend that focus back.
So you were kind of knocking the camera out at that moment?
Yeah, I just went to it really close. And I'm hoping that whoever's cutting that live is now going to call that and say, switch to this camera, because I needed to get that camera off my back. And it worked. It did. But if I didn't have that knowledge about moving towards that camera lens to throw off the rack focus, I would have been in a heated spot there.
Well, the TED Talks is available. This is one of the greatest things about the internet is that the stuff stays there. It's also one of the worst things in terms of your permanent record. But the Brain Game stuff is there also, which shows how good you are as a sleight of hand artist in the demonstration about focus. And, you know, you are talking people through appearing and disappearing items. But I think as much as you know about all of those things, it's the human condition. You really zoned in on how people feel, what they're thinking. That whole ability is transferable, that business of trust and that business of responsibility. You talk about these circumstances changing the contract, but isn't that what we all deal with every day in sales or in wanting somebody in our HOA to vote the way we want? All of it is some form of manipulation in a way.
If you were to ask someone, what's the difference between manipulation and motivation?
Isn't it about intent?
It is. And that's the interesting part, because it's still the tools. There are lessons to learn from one to move them to the other. So if I understand how people manipulate people, now if I want to add true intent to those, it becomes, okay, now what is true intent? Does that depend on what country I'm from? Did I get better intent than the other? So that's where some people like these will create justifications. But I think that there's a lot of lessons to learn of how someone moves someone to make one decision versus another. And you can pull some of those concepts out and use them in other areas. I think there are so many ways if you take the simplification of a concept to change someone's mind. But we tend to feel guilty about that. We tend to think of that only as manipulation.
There's a great phrase, what might make you change your mind? And in argument, that phrase, what might make you change your mind, or what might make you interested in doing this deal, makes the person look at it from your point of view. They have to reveal to you if there was more money, if it was safer. They immediately tell you how they could join your side if the circumstances were different. That's not even intended to be manipulation. It's actually meant to be a way that you can have a conversation on the same side as opposed to opposing.
I often think of that instead of opposing as kind of confluence, where you find yourself aligned to them, going toward a thing. And amplifying it, like that same type of thing, you run into it all the time. over consumer support. So you're calling in for changing your flight or something else has come up and that you're just running into a grind. And you use something similar to that, where if you just said, listen, you've seen this in ways that I haven't, you sound like you have a lot more experience with it. So what am I not seeing that you see? What would you recommend that I do next? And you're shifting their role into being a good Samaritan. And that functionally is a form of what you consider, instead of manipulation, it's compliance gaining. You're moving them towards a place of helping you get to a solution. But before that, they were locked into a frame of tug of war. I win, you win, I'm going to cancel this conversation. Instead, saying, how can I shift this relationship to another one? To say, I completely understand you got to go through this all day. I got my wife's family coming in and we just got to do this one thing. So what do you think I should explore next? And it's sometimes easier for them to push the button than to create something else with you. So they might just push the button for saying, I don't have time, so here, boop.
No, finding an advocate is a real art. And I will say that in today's day and age, divisiveness is the tool of trade, that this is our protocol. This is what they say. And you go, protocol? Well, I have protocol too. Our protocols conflict. So now what do we do next? So finding that, the humanity in it, I think is always the answer. That's my sense is, hey, I'm not capable of making this happen. And if there's a way that you can advise me or where to go or who to call, or if you put their thinking cap on as if they're solving it for themselves. And I always put humor on the thank you. A phrase I've used often is put yourself down for a Christmas bonus. And they laugh and go, oh, if only. Like, nobody here appreciates me. And I go, no, I do. And it'll be in your stocking at the end of the year. They just think it's hilarious. It makes their day.
A similar phrase that for me is like, find the play. You can think of that like heist, like the play or the con. But for me, I think of it as, if I can imagine them as a kid, when they were 8 years old and they were on the playground and we're going to talk, what's the thing? Where's the playfulness there? And can I bring out their inner kid? And sometimes that part can be just, what's the play going to be for this person to bring out their inner kid a little bit? And find a little bit of playfulness for that. And you kind of got to dance lightly to find that in people. But often when somebody's very stiff or very hard, it's just pushing around to find out, okay, where's the play at here?
So have you ever sat down to write a screenplay or a short or anything on this topic?
I haven't yet. No, I've thought about writing like a one-man show. I started gravitating further and further away from solo pieces. My wife and I formed another company. We've formed a couple now. And a lot of them focus towards the space of how can we use these understandings that we've come to and try to do something better for the future. And that was a big push from her. She had this advocacy that was really important to her. And we also wanted to make it non-political. We wanted to make it about, if we're able to identify people's blind spots, how can we help them identify their own blind spots to recognize these things about themselves and make better decisions. The experiences that we tend to create now are usually to try to help people have some insight. So if we could do a show, it doesn't require me necessarily to be on the bullseye, so to speak. I'm not looking to be famous, but same thing in the TV or other things or live. I would like to tell stories that help people make better decisions. And if taking them through a walk in this world of cons and heists helps them understand reality better, awesome.
You know, I had a scenario where people came to me to write political advertising, and I don't want to take sides. I said, hey, I'll write get out the vote ads. I'll do certain things where it's about us as human beings, but I'm not putting sides against each other. I'm absolutely not interested in being a part of a narrative where I don't know all the details or machinations or who's funding it, or like, I want nothing to do with that. And not only that, I don't want to be the writer and director that then asks a director of photography to compromise his values, or, you know, I just didn't want to get into the game playing of a manipulative storytelling.
And the divisiveness, which you mentioned earlier. I think a similar project, I was asked to do a video piece on why someone is a con man. And I said, rather than singling out this person and thinking of them a con man, you could reverse that, say why they're not a con man. Or we could just say, why do we miss things? Because what is the behavior you would want? Are you dividing us versus them? Or are we trying to bring people together? And if we could show them that, let's just explore why we miss things. And then we can show in society why more of us need to be in the middle and less on the edges.
To that end, the one spot that I was proud of that we didn't end up making was the dividing sides. I had what looked like a pickup, the ball game kind of young kids picking teams, and half had red jerseys and half had blue jerseys. And the kid with the red jersey was picking all kids with red, and the blue were picking all blue. And on the side, there was like some kids in white running a lemonade stand. And then when you, it wasn't turned out not to be a ball game. It was a big mud slinging fight, but mud was getting on everybody. Mud was getting on the lemonade stand kids and all of that. And the tagline was, let's stop thinking red versus blue and start thinking red, white, and blue. I was very proud that it was neutral. And the second they looked at it and loved it, they go, hey, could we have this person in the with this colored jersey be the first one to throw the mud? I go, no, we don't want to see the source. It doesn't, nobody started it. This is not what this means. But they were intent on trying to make it an ad about their side. And I just was like, I'm out. But to me, it's just what you said. Leave them with insight. Leave them not thinking about the cleverness of the ad, but where do they stand in that?
Absolutely.
If you were advising somebody from the outside, a speaker, a storyteller of any kind, the advantage they can take about people's attention from the standpoint of being a speaker, coming on stage and grabbing people's attention and hanging on to it, with your experience as a speaker and your awareness of how to deal with people's attention, what advice would you give that person?
Yeah, it starts with expectations, is what I would say. What did they expect to see? And then you can choose, are you going to align with that or are you going to challenge their expectation? An example, that one time I was doing a talk at a conference, an International Society for Neuroscience conference, 30,000 people. And in the room, it was 10,000 people and then people were being broadcast around. It was a very large venue for me. And when I walked in, I saw that they had a spotlight operator in the back and they would point that spotlight operator towards the wall as people walked in. And I asked him, I said, can we do the same thing every time that everybody that walks in, the spotlight's going to go to this spot and they come walking onto the stage? He said, yes. And I said, and we got like three speakers before me. Great. So there's a pattern. So I'm setting the expectation observably, right? Then when they introduce me and you see this video that talks about this thief and sitting among the audience, the spotlight goes to the spot, but I never show up. It was a thing that now sitting in the audience, all they could do is hear me. And I said, so that's the thing, right? You see a video like that, and then a spotlight tells you where to look. And now all you do is hear my voice. I said, how do you feel? But right now, I'd now have 10,000 people really wondering where I am. And you see them looking left and right, checking their wallets, checking their bags. And that capturing of the imagination wasn't through some big spectacle. It was just the setting the expectation of the spotlight going to the same spot. And now just having the voice and playing with the unknowns. And I think that there's often that. There's often the room to contextually look for what are the expectations and how can I play with that with the unknowns.
Well, what a great way to illustrate immediately, because you are in the confidence game, you're usually several steps ahead of your audience. So they would never suspect that you would have seeded that with the spotlight pattern. And I think that's what makes movies like The Sting so fantastic, is that, you know, we get to watch it unfold as if we have a bird's eye view of the thing as opposed to being the rube.
And I think probably your background with being a magician, it probably gives you so much intuition when it comes to the storytelling, I would imagine. Because it's, as I recall, one of the effects that you were known for was a kind of a variation of paper balls over the head, wasn't it?
Yeah, a Slidini trick for the listener, where you're dealing with one audience member on stage, and as you're vanishing things, the audience is fully aware of it, but the person on stage is not.
And that balance is very similar to me with the pickpocket. And not all magicians have experience with that duality of the management of two audiences, because you being able to manage and know where that person is right then, that surfing of their attention, and knowing what the audience is tracking, and also that the audience doesn't get out of hand and ruin that for that person. But the management of two audiences becomes a bit of a thing. I think magic requires us to have a kind of projected empathy into the future, that we have to be able to predict what the story is that our audiences will tell themselves when they hear the story or when they observe it. And our accuracy in fooling them in a magic trick or managing their attention is directly correlated to how well we can predict that in an empathetic way for our audience.
And at the same time, not to embarrass the person, because you're communicating to your audience that the person is safe and they're having a good time. It's very, very important, because that could be them. And if you embarrass or humiliate a person on stage, everyone turns on you because they think you have a big advantage. So one of the things I like to do is give them responsibility. I always like to say to them, hey, you're the eyes and the ears of the audience. Nobody's going to be closer to the sleight of hand than you. It's like being deputized.
And you have to empower them. What you mentioned about the bully, I mean, I run into that all the time. Even though I'm a little guy, I get big guys up and they'll just become really nervous because of my reputation or other things. And I mean, I did this to Charles Barkley, and he's a pretty intense character. And he was like, no, that's not happening to me. And that tug of war is great when he has such a personality and he has such a confidence level. But other times I've been stealing from a guy and his palms started sweating. And I realized if he sees that his palms are sweating, then he's going to amplify it to himself and he's going to start getting nervous and the audience is going to feel sorry for him. So as I reach across, I use my sleeve to wipe off the sweat off his palm so he doesn't see it. But I have to kind of shepherd him to make sure that he doesn't get in that feedback loop to take care of him while he's there.
Well, my biggest tool is humor. And so on the occasion of having Warren Buffett, one of the wealthiest men in the world, up on stage, I wagered him $1 that I could cut his tie up and restore it to the same one. After having done a rope trick and proof that I had this power, and I whacked the tie off the middle, and then I said, I lose, here's your dollar. And I didn't restore it. It was hilarious, and he was a good sport about it. But because he's such a financial wizard, he took the dollar with pride and said, you have no idea what I can turn this into. And he got the last laugh. So the relationship, when you make the volunteer out of the audience your partner to entertain the crowd, and you tandem jump out of the plane and you in safely together on the ground, everybody wins.
Yeah.
Warren is just notoriously frugal. And he had a great sense of humor about it. And the audience rallied behind him. That made me feel like, oh, good. This was much more about putting him at a high status at the end, as opposed to saying I could fool this great investor.
And that's going to be so much of it, doesn't it? The ability to forge a relationship with them that they, to your earlier point, trust. And that's where confidence and trust can go well together, like for con games. But trust as an entertainer, as a storyteller, what does the audience think the relationship is? And defining that. I play in this interesting space when I, a lot of times in talks, and I frame my relationship to the audience as kind of like an unreliable narrator, is what you call it in storytelling. But mine as a speaker is, I'll tell them that as we begin, Hayden has this line, a famous magician in our world, you can trust me, you just have to know when to trust me. And so much of that is, I'm going to trip you until you learn how to step over the foot. And that's kind of the social contracts that happens. They know that I'm going to be playful. They know that I'm going to say things that are very convincing. But then continually, if they don't look twice, then they will fall into a trap of some sort. For that reason, usually when I do workshops, I have other team members that are facilitating, and they know that they can trust them and they support their teams. It's an interesting kind of tug of war because it keeps everybody very vigilant whenever they're around me, because they're very worried about what my alternate agenda might be. Yet they trust me as the overall piece of them trying to teach them or moving them to a certain type of insight or to have an epiphany. But I choose to do this unreliable presenter as kind of my defined relationship with them.
Well, they can see that demonstrated on your TED Talk on the Art of Deception and many other things just by Googling. But they can also go to apollorobbins.com to get an eyeful of your services and find out a little bit more about your entertainment or your training or education. I so appreciate you investing the time today. And I know you've already got my watch and my wallet, but I want to add to that my thanks.
It was a pleasure. And thank you for having me on. It's such a flattery. I'm such a big fan of you and many of the guests that you've had on. So thanks for taking the time.
Well, you have such a unique perspective, and I can't wait to see you tell a bigger story.
Thank you.
All right. Cheers, pal. Thanks for joining us. We know you have many choices in the podcast universe, so we appreciate you investing the time to be a part of our creative community. Creativity in Captivity is produced by Sweetwood Creative in Austin, Texas, with support from co-producer and audio wizard Tucker Hazel. This episode was edited by the Right Honorable Tanner Dykstra. Original theme song written and sung by Maya Sharp. Additional support and technical jiggery-pokery provided by Diane Johansson and Tony Deo of Ghost Runner Records. Feel free to check out our archived episodes at creativityincaptivity.fun. You're hearing that right. It's .fun. So much fun, the punctuation can't even follow it. Ciao for now. Staring at an empty page, stepping